This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Pod bless everybody. I'm your host of OPP, Corey Cambridge. And before we get started with this amazing episode, I want to tell you about my other show, Silent Giants. Silent Giants is a podcast that highlights superstars behind the scenes of popular culture. Ever wondered who made the MTV logo? Did you know the person who wrote Earth, Wind & Fire's hit song September also wrote the theme song for the hit 90s TV show Friends? On Silent Giants, we learn more about these amazing people and dig deep to learn more about their most famous works. Be sure to check out Silent Giants on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Now, let me introduce you to our special guest of OPP.
Hi, I'm Garth Mullins. I'm the host of Crackdown, and you know me. This is OPP, Other People's Podcasts.
God bless everybody and welcome back to another episode of OPP, Other People's Podcasts, America's number one podcast discovery platform that highlights your favorite podcasters and the dope shows they created. I'm your host, Corey Cambridge. Our special guest this episode is Garth Mullins, host of the hit Canadian podcast, Crackdown, a monthly podcast about drugs, drug policy, and the drug war reported by drug users themselves. Each episode of Crackdown will tell the story of a community fighting for their lives. In this interview, we get to learn more about Garth, his personal battle with opioid use, how the crisis is affecting his native Vancouver, we get his podcaster's picks, and of course, we chat about his amazing podcast, Crackdown. Now, on to my exclusive interview with Garth Mullins.
Yo, man, Garth, how are you, bro?
You know, I'm good. It's always good to talk to other radio people. And yeah, I'm really stoked to be on the OPP.
I'm a big podcast fan, obviously. And I listen to a lot of podcasts, man. And I'm just going to be dead ass with you. This is the most important. It's not even about the word favorite. It's about the word important. Crackdown is the most important podcast of 2019. I heard about this through Archie Mann of Canada Lands Commons. And he was, you were one of his podcaster's picks. And I go through every person's podcaster's picks. I listen to all the episodes and, you know, try to get the folks on the show. Crackdown is amazing. I just want to say, you know, Pa bless you, because this is an amazing, amazing podcast.
Wow, Corey, thanks very much. I'm flattered. I love Archie's work, and I heard your interview with him, and it's great to be part of that conversation. We just kind of started this little radio show up here, and you know, I played in punk bands and little local bands, and so you get used to, oh, here's a dozen people showed up at the crappy bar where you're playing. So you kind of have low expectations of an audience, like maybe a few people listen, like maybe my friends or something. And then when people actually listen to the thing that you're making, you're kind of unprepared for it in a weird way, you know?
Oh, 100%, man. It boggles my mind even with my with OPP, when people reach out of nowhere and say, like, yo, I want to be a guest on the show. And I'm like, how did you even hear about it? You know, like, I'm just an independent guy here in Brooklyn. So, man, you mentioned that you have a background in music. Tell me more about your background and who Garth Mullins is as a human, as a man.
My background in music is pretty, like, I'm self-taught radio journalism and music. So I'm kind of still learning, I guess would be the best way to say it. So I'm a pretty utilitarian guitar player, but I've always thought of music as a good vector for politics. And, you know, so I played in bands and Toured around a little bit. I played in Alphabet City in New York in a club called ABC No Rio. Back in the day, it's near Tompkins Square Park.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever played in Brooklyn, but it's a good way to get to meet people, and it's a good creative outlet. So yeah, I guess. But I guess my in a broader sense, my background is I've been an opioid user for pretty much my whole adult life. A big chunk of that, most of that would have been injection heroin, and I'm on methadone now. And I lost half of the people I came up with. Like half the people I came up with are gone, dead. And I guess out of like anger and grief and survivor's guilt, I felt like I had to put some of my skills toward that and kind of mix up some activism and some radio and see if something couldn't come out of that.
What was your personal, what was the culture like, and how did you first, become a user? How did that even happen? And what was the culture like around you at that time?
Well, I was pretty young as a teenager. I was, I was pretty alienated. I sort of was carrying around a lot of trauma from earlier stuff that I never figured out very much. So, didn't feel like the world was where I was supposed to be. I felt like an alien, and so you get messed up, you get drunk, you do a bunch of drugs, and then I did heroin, and all of a sudden that howling alienation, that big tidal wave of crap that bangs into you every minute, it just was switched off. It just stopped. And I can't remember exactly the first time. Like, I don't have this story, but boy, I sure do remember sitting in, and I guess near Larkin Street in San Francisco. And I just had a load of black tar heroin on board, and the sun was shining, and which isn't much in San Francisco. It's like a gauzy kind of a light. And, I just felt like, hey, this feels normal. This must be what everybody else in the world feels like all the time. That's all right.
How many years ago was this?
Oh, man, this was in the 90s. Long time ago. It's like when a human like me would still be tolerated in San Francisco, I think.
Is that where you're...
I know there's still lots of people who live there from all kinds of backgrounds, but it's changed. The city's changed a lot since then.
Are you originally from there?
No, I was just living in California. It was after I was there, in the years after the big earthquake of 89, there was a lot of buildings that were, earthquake damaged and abandoned, but not knocked down. So you could pretty much live rent free. And, I was working at a club called the Gilman Street Project where bands played. And, I was just trying to, figure out what I was supposed to do with myself.
Through your journey, with opioid use, tell me the trials and tribulations of trying to wean yourself off or get off of heroin.
Yeah. So the first thing I did, I guess, you sort of realize suddenly, oh, I'm wired. Like if I stop, I'll be sick. And that's always a little surprise, even though you've watched all the after school specials and heard the warnings from Nancy Reagan or whoever else, or DARE at your school. You're just like, I'm in over my head. So then you get a plan to just quit cold turkey. And that is excruciating because not only is it, 100 times worse than the worst flu you've ever had physically, but all that howling alienation I was talking about, that all crashes down back on you right at the same time. And, so I toughed that out. I tried to a couple times, and then lots of times because of money or, maybe being incarcerated, you don't always have a choice about that, but, it never really stuck. And then my ability to go through it, to white knuckle through it, just evaporated. Like once you know how bad it is, you sort of you don't have the resolve anymore to withstand it. My weaning myself off started to change form, and I was trying to use less or use more carefully or substitute it for something else. And eventually what worked for me was methadone, but methadone is also a drug. It's an opioid. It's, it's like a nicotine patch. You're still getting nicotine. It's just, you're not smoking anymore. And so that's what I take, you know, I take every morning. It just, you know, an hour or two before we started talking here, I took my methadone, and it stops you from feeling that dope sickness. It stops you from feeling that craving. And eventually you don't, you know, if you sort it out right, you don't need to use heroin.
What is the misconception around the opioid crisis from your personal perspective? You feel like people don't know or don't understand?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting connection, right? Because if you're Black or Indigenous up in Canada, it's, you know, like Native American, but Indigenous in Canada, you're way more likely, if you're a drug user, to get into some kind of situation with law enforcement, you know, because just like in the U.S., the law enforcement up here, the cops are really, they're just all about the racial profiling and all that. And so they stop and card or stop and search people of color way more than they do people who aren't. And so that puts a whole bunch of extra pressure on people, because as a drug user, you're criminalized, and you have those added layers of extra attention from law enforcement if you're a person of color. And when you're criminalized, that means you are trying to hide from the cops. So if you're using drugs, you might be trying to use more quickly or more furtively. So you can't be careful. You can't try a little bit first and see how strong it is. The cops are always arresting dealers, so the source where you get the drugs from is always being disrupted. So the quality is always changing. So we've tested a whole bunch of drugs up here, a whole bunch of what's sold as heroin, and we found in it pig dewormer and household cleanser and brick dust and concrete and all kinds of stuff, always lots of fentanyl, and mostly not any heroin. And that's because of the criminalization. So, I mean, I guess the thing that people don't realize is how police make the lives of drug users so much more dangerous, so much more deadly. And then once you get into those situations with law enforcement, you know, if you're carted off to jail, you spend a weekend or you spend longer there, you get out, your tolerance has changed. Yeah, you're still going to use, but maybe you don't have a sense of what's dangerous for you or as clear a sense anymore. So that's dangerous too. So a lot of people have had interactions with law enforcement really shortly before they've overdosed and died. And so the cops are making things way worse. They're causing this crisis. They're exacerbating the crisis.
What is the drug culture specifically like in Vancouver?
Well, we're Port City. This is where the drug war really got going in North America, actually. So we started to outlaw hard drugs in Canada before you did in the U.S. So in 1907 here, just about a kilometer from where I am right now, there is a big like white racist riot, like a pogrom of anti-immigrant residents who were just upset. They were sort of taken against the Chinese workers that had been building the railroad. And so they had a big rally at City Hall. It was very official. And then they all went and smashed up businesses and everything. And then some government officials came out here from the capital back east, and they wanted to assess the damage and do we need to compensate anybody? And so they were kind of looking at the businesses, and they realized, oh, there's opium production going on here. Like, people are smoking opium. And the report even said this is a threat to white women and girls. And so shortly after that, this was sort of one of Canada's first big drug panics. The Opium Act is passed in 1908. So 1907, people just smoke opium. 1908, it's illegal. And now you got to figure out, stronger, more concentrated, more bang for the buck kind of a way to transport the stuff. It's kind of like, you know, before alcohol prohibition, everyone drank beer. And then the day after, it's going to be moonshine and all that. So it's like an arms race of stronger dope ever since then. So you get, from smoking opium to heroin to injecting heroin to what they call China White, which is strong heroin in the 90s. That was the first overdose crisis in Canada that I went through. And then you get fentanyl and carfentanyl, and each is stronger. And the more they're illegal and the more the police chase them down, the stronger they get. So the drug culture here is, it never stands still. There's always like a next stronger thing. And at the same time, what's specific about the drug culture in Vancouver, at least the people I'm around, is that during that first overdose crisis here in the 90s, people started organizing. So we formed a drug users union and started making demands of government and started actually coming out and saying, yep, we use drugs. Yeah, we're dope fiends. Here we are. And it's kind of revolutionary because you're supposed to feel pretty ashamed about that and not ever talk about it, certainly not publicly, because your life will suffer. It's hard to rent an apartment or get a job if people think you're, you're a drug user, like, oh, you're a junkie, you're going to steal things from work and wreck the apartment or something. And so that was the drug culture I knew, is where people started to organize and push back. And that meant doing things that were not legal and not permitted, like the first safe injection sites in Vancouver, thus the first in North America, were opened illegally without permission. The first needles that I ever got were distributed by people who worked in the medical field, but who stole stuff from work and gave it out in their backpacks. Mm-hmm. And that was true here and in San Francisco. People did that too. And so that kind of civil disobedience, lawbreaking, you know, I think that's common to every struggle, every group of people who wants to fight for their rights and get some dignity. I see that's like the way it works, you know, the way history moves.
Wow. Garth, we're going to take a quick break. When we get back, we're going to do a deep dive into your podcast, Crackdown.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
And Garth, we're back. I want to ask you a question. Take it way, way, way back. How did you first hear of the medium of podcasting?
I always liked radio. You know, ever since I was a kid, I listened to shortwave and you know, like just whatever weird radio signals you could find. And I guess I first became aware of podcasting, you know, 10 or maybe more years ago. And I can't remember what the first podcast I listened to was. It might have been Savage Love, you know, Dan Savage's podcast about sex and stuff.
Yeah.
And I just thought, oh yeah, podcasting on the radio, podcasting is actually radio in the computer, but you don't need a radio station, you don't need a transmitter, you don't need hardly anything. And I'd always thought that was a good kind of medium from there.
Did you ever think that you would become a podcaster yourself?
Yeah, it seemed inevitable in a weird way. I was a freelance, writer and radio producer. So I made documentaries for the equivalent of NPR up here sometimes. And eventually I thought that I would wind up doing that. And so I was still learning and kind of teaching myself and I still am, but I felt the call from a long way off.
For the audience, I'm sure, you know, at this point in the interview and from, you know, the introduction that I'm going to give, they're going to have a pretty good sense of what Crackdown's about. But from your words, can you give me an elevator pitch of Crackdown?
Sure. It's drug users covering the drug war as war correspondents. So we're looking at the drug war, at the overdose crisis, and trying to put the tools of science and investigative journalism into the hands of the people who are in the bullseye of this thing.
What was the origin and the light bulb moment for you to start this podcast?
So I was telling you about how there's this drug user activism culture in Vancouver. And so we sort of have to push our way into some official meetings, you know, with government people where health stuff is decided and policing stuff is discussed. So we kind of badger our way into those meetings. But once you're in the door, they don't believe you. You know, they look at you. Like, what kind of scam are you pulling? You guys are all always up to something. Like, you can just tell when someone doesn't believe you, you know? And so I met this guy, Dr. Ryan McNeil, who is, you know, a research scientist at the Faculty of Medicine at the University of British Columbia. And he did believe the things we were saying. And in fact, he would be willing to study some of them with us, you know, to do research. And his findings tended to support some of the things we were experiencing as drug users, you know, some of the negative outcomes of different policies from the government. And so we tried taking him with us to the meetings. And so all of a sudden, the government wasn't so quick to, you know, basically roll their eyes at us. We had a little bit more legitimacy. And I was walking out the door with him one time and we were kind of talking. And so they're listening to us, but we're still not getting anything done with them. They're still not, you know, helping us out in the ways that we were looking for. But we said, so this might not be, you know, very effective at changing policy, but it might make good radio. And Ryan was like, you know, we could probably find some academic funding to support something like that. And that's where the idea was born.
What has the response been in Canada to this podcast?
Well, so yeah, I just, like I was saying, I don't know. I didn't know if anybody was going to listen, you know, but we went to the top of iTunes in Canada really fast. And so that really surprised me. And today, actually this morning, our producer Sam and Ryan are going to Chicago to the Third Coast Festival to pick up an award. We won something there, which is, it's an extremely prestigious radio award that's given out there once a year. And so we're super humbled and stoked that they would even hear us and you know, listen and like it enough. Of course, like I would go but we have an editorial board also of drug users who sort of oversee the show, but we can't get across the border because the U.S. does not welcome you in if you have a criminal record very easily. So we sent our producer Sam and Ryan, who were the people we were sure that could get across the line there. That just represents a kind of response that I was unprepared for. I mean, I have been just moved and humbled also by the people who are drug users, who are living the crisis, who listen to the podcast and write me. And they don't have the culture that we do around here. They don't have the drug user union, and they don't have sort of comrades that they're relying on and struggling on. So many people experience this crisis alone, you know, like by themselves, just struggling to get by, or maybe they're a family member of someone who's died and they feel alone and in grief. And the fact that those people, you know, get in touch and listen is really moving. I always feel when I write back, I always feel like my words are so inadequate to match their experience and they're reaching out. But I mean, that's probably the most important thing to me about who listens is the people who, you know, who are living this. And then sometimes we're able to give information that people can go then take into their lives and change them and make something a little better out of it. And when I hear about that, I'm just like, oh shit, that's why we do this.
What is the message and the intention that, you know, you want to get across with Crackdown?
Well, I mean, we wrote the theme song that you hear at the top of the show. And I think that we try to capture that. We try to capture the spirit of resolve and anger and urgency with that. You know, the first thing you hear of the theme is feedback, you know, guitar feedback. And we try to communicate that kind of urgency, but also like a sort of a roughness. Like it's not as pretty a song as they have at the start of the Daily, the New York Times podcast, for example, which I do like that theme actually, but so it's like we are trying to communicate that. And then throughout the show, we try to identify a few things. Like the overdose crisis is not a force of nature. It's a force of policy. So it's not just something that is happening for no reason. There are powerful people who are responsible for the continuation of the crisis. And those people have titles and occupy positions. And those are the villains. And we need to point out who they are. And there are also people who are fighting back, and sometimes we win. And when those victors emerge, we want to celebrate them. And we also want there to be demands, like things that we're calling on the government to do that aren't just made up by me behind the mic, but reflect a real community desire for something. So that rootedness in the community is the last thing I would say that I want people to feel, is that this doesn't come from just a couple people. This is the effort of an editorial board, which has got 8 people on it, and it has 7 now, actually, because we did lose Cherise Kiwat and died in February. Yeah. So we want people to feel that rootedness and that community accountability.
Garth, personally, you know, what have you learned about yourself from this podcast? And, you know, how has this podcast helped you in your personal struggle with opioid use?
Me and my opioid use have kind of reached a detente, like a peaceful coexistence right now. So it's got a certain stability to it. My Twitter friend Meg says, you know, there's this expression, you got a monkey on your back when you're wired. It's kind of an old expression. I love the old timey expressions for drug stuff. Like people used to call heroin horse. I wish I was around in those days, but, there's this expression, you got a monkey on your back, and Meg says, you got to train the monkey. You know, it's lovely to have the idea of getting the monkey off your back entirely or away from you or not being pestered by a monkey anymore. But, you know, for those of us who've been like a lot of years with this particular monkey, we kind of got to make some peace with it. So, I mean, that's where I am. But what I've learned about myself is that I've gone through a lot of my life just not examining things. Like stuff happens and I'm like, well, that sucked. On to the next thing. Let's not think about that. And you kind of repress and you throw that stuff away. And suddenly I have to go back and think about it in ways that could make a little scene on a radio show. So I have to kind of remember, oh yeah, what kind of shirt was that guy wearing or something like that. And it really brings back stuff. And so I realized things have happened to me that I kind of wasn't consciously thinking had happened to me. Like, for example, I myself overdosed. But because I don't really have clear memories from that whole day, I never really thought, oh, I'm one of those people who's overdosed, until this summer, and we're making this show and I'm talking to some of the people who were around then, and they're like, oh yeah. Like I remember I was told, you were in the back of an ambulance and then you got out and you kind of talked your way away from them and you walked around the corner and then we found you like lying on the pavement around the corner. And I don't remember any of that stuff. And I probably never would have had I not gone dredging it up. So yeah, it's not great stuff to find out about yourself. But on the other hand, hey, you know, I'm just lucky to be alive. I'm stoked to be around. I guess I'm resilient enough to keep rolling. So those are good things to learn about yourself, too.
Wow. Garth, we are at a point of the show called our Podcaster's Picks. Now, this is when I ask the guests of today's show to give me their top 3 favorite podcasts that they enjoy that we should be listening to. So, Garth, take it away.
I'm going to say the one show that people should listen to is Thunder Bay. It's a podcast about a town in Canada that is so it's so important, and it's so relatable to people living in the US too. It's a town in Ontario where a lot of Indigenous kids come from more remote reserve communities, or what's called reservations, I guess, in the US, and they go to school there. And these kids keep winding up dead in the river. And the town is just full of nasty racism and corruption, and also full of people who are trying to change that stuff and fight back. And my friend and radio producer, Ryan McMahon, makes the podcast, and it's fantastic. You should give it a listen. It's really good. There's a BBC podcast over the summer, I think, and it was called Forest 404. And it's a story. It's fiction, speculative fiction about the future, where there's no nature. And there's a sound recording of a forest, and it's illegal. And hearing it awakens this this longing in people for a different world. And so it's quite revolutionary to hear this sound. And so it's the struggle of the people who found this sound to get it to other people and to outrun the authorities. But the sound design on the show is just great. I really liked just listening to it for the sound design. So that was very cool. And I would also just check out Cited Media. They are the hired guns that we have that help us manage the incredible volume of tape and edit the interviews and get it into a nice order and make sure we're putting it up in all the platforms. They're the infrastructure of this. I mean, this is, and they're, you know, Sam Fenn and I have really a storytelling, cult, I guess, of trying to figure out story structure and all that stuff. Or I guess I'm joining his, but anything that Cited Media makes, I think is worth giving a listen. The Cited podcast itself is about ideas that emerge from academia, but aren't really what you think.
Okay,
and that's an odd take as well. But I really enjoy it, and so I think that those are three. But it's very hard to choose. It's very hard to choose favorites. I would also add that in the States, Narcotica is a podcast about the overdose crisis in the US, and you know, it's very different from what we do, but it's a fantastic podcast, and they have a real, like, you can really go through their back catalog and pick the issues that you want to know more about. And it's you know, there's three journalists that host that thing, and they really got it buttoned up there.
And
wait, that was four. I said four. Sorry.
It's all right, man. It's all right. It's all right.
It's some kind of metric imperial weights and measures conversion problem here, I think.
and Garth, why do you podcast, my man?
Well, you know, I was a freelancer. Like I said, I made radio documentaries for the public radio here. They didn't want this idea. I mean, not really. Like we ended up going with a much better version of it. So maybe I just didn't pitch it very well. I'm terrible at pitching articles and ideas. It's just, I'm not good. I was a writer for a local newspaper here, like a, you know, big circulation, 300,000. I was a columnist, a weekly columnist, and believe me, that pays poorly. And then they fired me because it's a right-wing newspaper and I'm basically a socialist. and then haha, their newspaper went out of business a month later. So it's just, at one point you're just like, shit, you know, nobody else has got the right platform to do this. I guess we're going to have to do it ourselves. And that's really the tradition with drug user activism too. It's like, we know no one's coming to save us. We know no one's going to do it for us. So we have to do it ourselves. And that's sort of like the punk rock spirit that I grew up with too. It's like, so you don't really know how to play your instruments, right? You get in a band, you do what you can, you learn along the way. And, you know, that's just why and how I do it, you know?
Well, Garth Mullins, man, let me tell you, Crackdown has changed the way that I see podcasting, man. It's unbelievable. And you have a gift, I'm telling you, and I really hope that this comes through in this interview, how much of a fan I am of Crackdown and the work that you're doing, man. And God bless you, brother. And this is incredible.
Thanks very much for having me. I love the breadth of interviews that you have on your show, and keep it up. Keep it up.
Thank you so much. God bless you.
All right. Yeah, thank you. Cheers. Take it easy.
Later, Garth. Thank you all so much for checking out another episode of OPP, and to our special guest, Garth Mullins. You can find Crackdown on Apple, Spotify, and wherever else you listen to podcasts. Also, be sure to support Crackdown by following the show on Patreon. This episode was mixed by Joshua Coleman. Music for this episode was produced by Richie Quake. And are you down with OPP? If so, be sure to leave us a 5-star rating in the Apple app. And let me know your favorite podcast in the review section. Lastly, before we get out of here, be sure to check out my other show, Silent Giants, a podcast that highlights the superstars behind the scenes of popular culture. And you can find Silent Giants on Apple, Spotify, and wherever else you listen to podcasts. I'm your host, Corey Cambridge. God bless y'all. Till next time.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.